Welcome back to the Effective Ministry Podcast, the podcast that helps you have an effective youth and children's ministry in your local church. My name is Tim Bielhartz. I'm a children's ministry advisor for YouthWorks in Sydney. I'm joined today by my colleague and return podcast guest, Beck Baines. How are you, Beck?
Hey, I'm doing very well, thank you.
Excellent. We are also joined by Luke Graham, who I'm told is the assistant minister, especially responsible for kids and youth ministry at Canterbury Anglican Church. Does that sound right, Luke?
Nailed it.
Something like that. Perfect. That is brilliant. Hey, we're here at House Conference. If we can hear some echo, it's because we're in a weird hall down at the Deer Park sites. And we also have some ambient rain settling in above us as well. So if you've got some background noise happening, that's what's going on. But if you've been following the podcast the last few episodes, we've particularly been thinking about discipling the emotions of young people. We're about halfway through the conference. We've heard both papers now by Kamina Wurst and Dr. Keith Condy. And so we've been thinking about what it looks like to disciple the emotions of young people. And I flagged on a couple of episodes ago, the question I've got is, a lot of the conversation in the papers assumes a neurotypical person and that we can converse with them, we can talk about their emotions, we can analyze their emotions. And particularly working with Beck, particularly thinking about my own circumstances, my immediate reflex was, okay, great, what about neurodivergent children and youth? Luke, you've got a massive passion in this area. Do you want to give us a little bit of a personal background, a ministry background? How did you get involved and interested in this idea of neurodiversity?
Yeah, God gave me so many opportunities to work with neurodivergent young people, especially. I did a Bachelor of Social Work as my undergrad, which I really adored. And while I was doing that, I worked as a teacher's aide in a high school where, because I was doing a Bachelor of Social Work, they gave me more of the complex kids. So I worked a lot with kids with autism and what was called oppositional defiance disorder at the time, and ADHD in schools. And I also worked as a support worker, so working with young people in their homes and often taking them out to just go have fun and enjoy life together. Often I worked with level 3 autism, which is they were nonverbal and needed full-time support and care. And while I worked with them especially, I just had this reoccurring thought of, what would it look like for me to invite you to my church? Would there be a space for you to flap and dance and do all the things that are part of how God has made them? Is there really a space for them in the church that I am a part of, and in the churches that I see around? What would it look like for them to become a part of church? And it really broke my heart to imagine that that might not be possible, and it might not be a safe place for them.
Was that your assessment at the time, as you thought about your church and other churches you knew at that moment? You thought, actually, if I invited you tomorrow to come to church, what would your assessment of the space be?
Yeah, there was such an emphasis on polite appearances in church and not a lot of space in churches that I see around for making noise in the middle of services, and we really have to work hard even to get churches to appreciate having babies in the service who are going to make noise, and having an adult who might look like everyone else around them but need to make noises at different points, or need to get up and move around the room or whatever it is. I struggle to imagine them feeling really welcome at churches that I saw around. And that was just, really heartbreaking. And I wanted there to be a place for them to come and belong and know that they are loved and engage deeply with the gospel.
And that's been a passion of yours. You're helping, I guess, amongst peers, leading that conversation. We'll come to that expertise in just a second. Beck, we last talked to you back on episode 16. We're on episode 34 today. Episode 16, where you had just started in the role. I think you were a couple of days in.
Yep.
We've now been 7 months or so into the role. Your job is to go around looking at churches and assessing them, and not formally assessing, but just kind of giving your opinions on, are these places where all sorts of accessibility and inaccessibility issues come to the fore? Is it a welcoming, belonging space? Just give it a bit of a snapshot. Last 7 months, what have you noticed? What have you seen? What brings you joy? What worries have you got?
Yeah, for sure. It's been so exciting to meet up with different churches and meet up with different kids and youth ministers. I think definitely neurodiversity is a top need that is in the kids and youth ministry world, and even beyond that. A lot of people are concerned with, are we doing the right thing by the kids that are coming along? Are we catering to their needs? How can we help them feel included? And I think in some space I've been in, it's been just so encouraging and joyful to hear how they're thinking in their faith development. So they're not just sort of catering to behavioural needs and making everything, I guess, unified and harmonious in that sort of sense, but it's actually, how do these kids know God and how do I teach them God? And so it's been very exciting to encourage and empower people and give training to volunteers in those programs and ministries to welcome people in, but then also to encourage the faith development that is going on. So every church I've been to is different. They've got a different story. They've got different kids. That's the you know, neurodiversity there and spectrum in that sense, but just helping people be thinking through different ways of doing things and maybe even thinking through methodologies or pragmatics, like why do we do what we do and is the way we do a ministry conducive to effective learning and being together with kids, with one another.
And I'll put these links in the bottom of the episode in the show notes, but if you want to reach out to Beck and have her come along to your ministry or even just to talk on the phone or via email, mm-hmm. you can go to youthworks.net, look under the ministry support tab about our team, and you'll get all of Beck's details there. You certainly haven't been short of conversations over the last 7 months.
And please contact me because I love meeting people, love getting to know you and love hearing your stories and hopefully helping you in your journey there.
Yeah, it's certainly a key part of effective ministry is very much one that is welcoming and inclusive of those with different levels of accessibility. Let's get on to the topic of emotions. The first thing I'm wondering is, what are some examples of the neurodivergent conditions that might affect emotions?
There's so much of the neurodivergence that we see really is really deeply intertwined with what it means to feel and how to feel in what we might call appropriate ways. Mm. And so we're thinking about things like autism is a big one that we keep seeing being diagnosed, particularly at the moment, but ADHD and ADD. Another one that we've spoken quite a bit about with peers at this conference has been PDA, which is closely related to what I said before of oppositional defiance disorder, which is pathological demand avoidance. And that is really tied in with anxiety. It's been described to me as an anxiety-driven need for control. Mm. And so much of neurodivergence there's so much anxiety for young people with who are neurodivergent. It's really deeply entwined with the neurodivergent experience is a sense of anxiety.
I did notice that you mentioned what was called oppositional defiance disorder at the time. Would it be safe to say that we're still learning in this space?
Yeah, totally. And the research will show that things keep changing and adapting as we understand more of who we are and how we're made up, and that is just true of neurodivergence as well. As we understand more of the neurodivergent experience, there are things that we try in research and they seem to not quite fit, and so we try a different thing that fits a bit better. So language is constantly evolving, and so just as a side note, it's always really helpful to ask someone how to refer to them as well, like, because that is always evolving and always changing how people feel about that, and it's such an individual thing whether they're an autistic person or a person with autism or what sort of language they prefer around themselves. It's so helpful to ask someone around that because it's always evolving, the language that we use for all sorts of different conditions.
I think we talked about that last time, Beck, that person-first language or condition-first language, or and that it might even change person to person, personal preference, condition to condition. But
totally.
Yeah, absolutely. Indeed. Beck, how might someone who has one of these various neurodivergent conditions, how might they express emotions differently? What would I, as an observer, notice?
Yeah, so I guess everyone, in one sense, expresses emotions differently, and particularly people on the spectrum and people neurodiverse. It might come out in different ways. And one book I read, it was by Yana Pittman, maybe it was when I saw her in person, but she said that people on the spectrum do have big feelings and they do love. They just don't always know how to express it. And so sometimes when someone's getting overstimulated with sensory and things like that, it might come out as aggression or anger or throwing things or yelling or running away or things like that. And that might be because they don't know what is a good expression of how they're feeling, or it might be because they're not being listened to or, like, I guess, noticed before it gets to a point. And so they're trying to say, like, I'm trying to tell you how I'm feeling and things like that. Sometimes things might not come out in a true authentic way either, particularly in high school kind of realms and social dynamics and the unspoken social rules. People on the spectrum might not know how best to react in certain ways. And there's a lot of anxiety and a lot of, you know, what have I done wrong or what am I meant to do? Particularly if they have reacted in a way that's authentic to themselves, but it's not being received well by the people around them. So they might, you know, if they're doing stimming like flapping or making noise or jumping around because they're so excited, you know, and they're being told by peers, no, stop doing that, for instance. And then think, well, why don't people like me? What have I done wrong? What am I meant to do? And so I guess that's where masking sometimes comes in. They sort of try and mimic what's going on around them and what the people are doing in that sort of way. So it's quite a lot of different things. I think getting to know the person and how they are reacting and responding and listening to them, and whether that's listening by observing or listening like with your ears in that sense. Mm. But what is their communication? And so just because they're not expressing things in a way that their peers are expressing, it doesn't mean they're not feeling it as well. Maybe they need to be given permission to express in a different way, or maybe they need to be sort of taught this is different ways that we can express.
Yeah, I think there's so much we can learn from autistic people as well in the way that they can present often their feelings in their bodies in a way that so often I feel like I have to repress all of those feelings and not show them. I think there's really something to learn from that, and really something to grieve as well in we don't want our churches to be places where they have to mask, where they have to pretend to be something in order to be loved and known. But churches really should be the place where they're able to unmask and be more themselves than they are anywhere, because we believe in the gospel of grace that says everyone is welcome here. And so we really want our church to be places where everyone can unmask, not just neurodivergent people, but ourselves as well, that we want churches to be places where everyone can come and take off the mask that they wear. And that's more pronounced often for neurodivergent friends.
And just appreciating that God has made each and every person as they are, with purpose, in God's image. And so God hasn't made like a group of certain people and then, oh, here are the ones that didn't quite work out or anything like that. Or, this is how you treat those people. He's made us all one and equal. And let's celebrate that in our church. That is diverse, full of different people, full of different ways we connect and engage and support and minister to one another.
This may open a can of worms, but I guess one of the questions that might hang over this whole topic is a neurotypical person is more like what humanness should be, and any sort of neurodiversity is maybe evidence of fallenness. And I don't know, do either of you have any thoughts on that from a theological point of view, and how does that impact the way that we think about neurodiversity in the population, in those that we serve, those in our churches?
Yeah, it is such a can of worms, and it is, you know, what is a result of sin? What is the new creation going to be like? And things like that. And there's questions that we can begin to unravel and try to answer and whatnot. And sometimes it's just, we just don't know until we're in the new creation. Yeah. And we just are excited that we are worshiping. Like, any perception of the new creation is just going to be so much better than when we're actually there and all that sort of thing. Mm. And so I think kind of in the now, it's appreciating, as I was saying before, who God has made people to be, and the diversity and the different skills and gifts that people have. And so people on the spectrum will be hugely gifted in certain ways that other people are not, and have just such a unique way of looking at the Bible and connecting with God and a lens for it. In our table discussions, we're talking about the idea of, I don't feel connected to God, you know, how do we manage that in conversations? And, you know, one of the things I suggested in that discussion was, well, is that because there's an expectation that to feel close to God, you have to have had this feeling or this connection or this way you've done things or whatnot? But actually celebrating and enabling people to approach God as they are, in who they are, in a way that is helpful. And yeah, like, let's think through how churches can be just diverse in such a wonderful way.
Yeah, totally. And I mean, there's a whole other can of worms we could talk about fallenness and brokenness and how those things relate to neurodiversity. Some of those questions are really hard to answer. I think the thing that, like Beck was saying, is that we want to do is celebrate diversity that we have now in our churches, and all of us need to be humble enough to learn from everyone in our church. If we believe that the body is beautiful because it's diverse, that the eye can't say to the ear, I don't need you because I do all the important stuff, and we believe that neurodivergent people can be followers of Jesus, then we have to have spaces in our church where their contribution to our churches are celebrated and recognized. That's just so important to have that. There's a beautiful church in Singapore that I think does this really well. They really celebrate the contribution that the neurodiverse people bring, neurodivergent people bring. So they celebrate when someone reads the Bible really slowly, because that's where the way they're able to communicate, because that helps us all sit in the Bible and stew in it and just take it a little longer. I think sometimes the best thing we can do is be a non-anxious presence, not be so worried about things running exactly to time or, property getting broken. Sorry, parish councillors and wardens who might be listening. Yeah, celebrating the contributions that all people at our church can make, including neurodivergent people, because if we believe that they're followers of Jesus, and I hope that that is a non-negotiable, and we believe that they're a part of the body, then their contribution is valuable, not just their presence.
Yeah, so theologically, we've got imageness, like every human being is inherently image of God. We've all got that regardless of any ability, disability, inability we have. We're all image bearers. Mm. And you're right, if they're in the church, they're part of the church family, then of course, they're part of the body. We want them to be contributing in some way. Let's think about then our children and youth ministry specifically, and you guys can break this up in whatever sort of age categories or breakdown you want, but how do I do ministry to children and youth, knowing that a number may be neurodivergent, and if you want to relate it particularly to their emotions, the big feelings that they might have and might express in different ways. But yes, how do I start to make welcoming spaces for those who are neurodivergent?
Across the board, communication is a key thing. So being able to communicate with parents very well and then them being able to channel that to their kids, being able to communicate with the kids themselves, whether they're tiny tots or, just about to turn into an adult, how do we communicate well? So you can do that, through the spoken word and just talking with them, managing expectations, sharing what things are going to be like for the day or for the week ahead, things like that, making the most use of visuals and things you can see, and kind of almost over informing in some way. So whether it's on a projector screen, whether it's in a handout they're holding, whether it's through an Instagram post or things like that, kind of overfeeding just so there's preparedness, understanding what's going on.
And the idea here is that we're lowering the anxiety for them. Is that a large part of what we're doing?
Yeah. It's a lot of preparedness. They know what they're coming in for. Reduced anxiety, and even just kind of mentally going, okay, well, I know that this aspect of the program is going to be a bit more of a challenge, but I know that that's when it's got another part is when it's going to be easier. So, for instance, if the games and whatnot are a harder point, maybe because it's getting to know the program, they're getting to know you, the systems, and they've been communicated with what the day is going to look like, they can more or less endure a loud game time, perhaps, knowing that that's only going to be for a set time, because then it's going to just calm down into Bible teaching time and whatnot.
Yeah, and so all of that comes back to what you're saying, Tim, the lowering the anxiety. Like we've said a few times, a lot of what we see in the neurodivergent experience is anxiety around, am I doing the right thing? Am I showing the right emotion here? It's been described to me like a sixth sense, that particularly for autistic kids, that they're missing, that there's a social sense that they're missing. And so all of the little social cues that all of their peers are able to pick up on, they feel like they're missing out on. And so there's this whole world of anxiety they come into. And then you add to that, there's a heightened sensory experience. So all the little sensory moments that they experience can add to this mounting pressure of anxiety. And Beck was saying this yesterday in a chat we were having, but all the little things like the scraping of a chair, the harsh lighting, the smell of coffee, roasting for morning tea, all those things just accumulate in this anxiety. And if you imagine like a fizzy bottle, like a soda bottle that's getting shaken and shaken and shaken and shaken by lots of little things that are overwhelming them, by not knowing where to sit or how to be, by the sounds that are overwhelming them, it'll explode somewhere. And it might not be a thing that feels to us recognizable as something that might set someone off, but it might just be the last little thing in that fizzy bottle that leads them to explode and have a meltdown. And so anything we can do to help lower that anxiety is so helpful. And so much of that stuff that we do will be helpful for everyone. Like having like a visual timetable so that kids know exactly what's coming in. I know so many of my kids that just helps them feel like it's not just this random stuff that's coming, but they know actually after this game, we're going to have a Bible talk, and it helps them prepare as well. Things like over-communicating with parents, all those sorts of things are helpful for every kid. And it helps lower the anxiety of all the kids in the room. So you want to have that calm, warm space that kids are able to walk into where they feel confident in what's happening, and you want to remove as many barriers to them experience the grace and truth and beauty of the gospel as possible.
Yeah, I want to come back to the point about parents. One of our seven principles for effective ministry is that it's a clear partnership with parents, that we are in discipleship with alongside parents, and that's how we exist as church ministers. But before then, just let's get really practical. I'm thinking about almost my group, but just trying to think about groups that I've seen all over the place. Yeah. I've got this diverse group of kids, and we've talked this week at House about creating safe, spiritually formative places, which are places that have a warmth and a belonging for all the different needs. And I just think, you know, potentially if other churches might be like mine, I've got some kids who their particular additional need would be somewhere along the ADHD line.
Yeah.
And so they are hyper engaged, hyper energetic. They got to move their bodies. They're loud. And so for them, a spiritually formative place is going to be something that engages with their emotions and their vibrancy and their energy and their loudness. And they're going to appreciate all the things that helps them to spiritually engage in the way that God has particularly made them. Then there's also going to be kids in a diverse group. You don't have to get very big before you start to get a number of kids. And there'll be some that might have sensory overload. They might have a real sensitivity to overstimulation. And for them, they need quietness, they need calmness, they need safe spaces for them which are not loud and almost the exact opposite. And of course, you've got kids all over in between. And what am I doing as a ministry leader? How do I create spiritually formative places for all of these kids given the resources that I have?
Yeah, I think sometimes we're very attached to particular ways of doing things. We think if I'm running kids' church, it has to be a big, loud game that everyone is involved with. And if they're not involved with, it's a kind of a source of shame that they're not involved in that. And then it's got to move to this particular way of doing a Bible talk and then discussion groups, whatever. Yeah. And I don't want to...
sitting down, sitting still, hands in lap.
Yes.
While I monologue for 20 minutes. And
So we want to be not attached to form overly. We want to be attached to the thing that we're doing, which is we want our services to be places where kids can engage deeply with the gospel, have the opportunity to explore and deepen faith. And so does that mean maybe the big loud game that everyone has to be involved with, does that have to be a central part of our program? Can we have choice there? So we've just started introducing occasionally having three choices that you can do instead of a game at the start, where there's a big loud game you can go, there's a corner where you can go read, and there's some art you can, you know, there's some chalk you can put on a wall over here. Having some choice within your program can be a really powerful thing. The more you know your kids and are willing to be humble enough to put your own preferences aside, the more effective your ministry will be. If you know your kids and you know that there's a bunch of kids with ADHD who just need to move and run, I have a scripture class like that I do every Thursday morning who I adore and I love. And every single one of them, when I surveyed them, said their favorite thing at school was sport, and they're up and moving around and they're, yeah. But are there ways that they're in that class, There's lots of ways that they move around the classroom. We do lots of, choice activities where you move to one side of the room or the other. We do lots of, lots of things in the space, because the thing I want isn't a form. Like I don't think we need to be overly attached to the way we do it. If it's not working, then we can cut it. And as long as the thing that we're doing helps young people engage with and explore and take hold of the gospel for themselves.
So keep that why the main thing. Like, we're there to help disciple, spiritually form kids.
Yeah.
And it might mean that as leaders, we need to be experimenting lots of different options and trying thinking about the different kids and diversity of... I like that idea of options. Like, there's different ways you can engage, in small groups or in whatever it is.
Yeah.
Just coming back to the, in our last few minutes, this question about parents. Beck, both you and I, listening to Ed Drew's podcast, friend of the podcast, Ed Drew, was out in Australia recently. He has a podcast in the UK, Faith in Parents podcast. I'll link to a couple of key episodes. But one of the people he interviewed there talked about, as a parent, you have this child and you have hopes and dreams for your particular child. And it's kind of like planning a trip to France, and then the plane lands and you realise you're in Denmark. And you can either try and do all that you can to get back to France, or you can realise you're in Denmark and go, okay, well, here we are. We're in Denmark. Let's see what we can do here. Beck, I'll turn to you first. Having a child with neurodiversity can be quite anxiety-inducing and produce a whole lot of emotions and stress for parents. How can we, as partnering with parents in the discipleship of children, what's the family piece? How can we engage well with those families?
Yeah, so a lot of listening to the parents and hearing them and assuring them and reassuring them, things like that. I think some of the pathways of getting a child to effectively be part of a group can be hindered by a parent's anxiety, because they want their kid to thrive and they want their kid to be accepted. Or the other side is that they don't want to hear a lot of negative feedback. I think sometimes in some families, all they hear is, oh, so-and-so was really hard today, or so-and-so did this. And it's all just that negative sort of stuff. And so actually, how can we flip the positive things going on? So again, in our chat at house yesterday on the table group, we talked about what are the things that bring you joy? What are the things that are really cool about this kid that you've got in your ministry? And feeding that back to the parents. And, we delight that your kid is here and we want to help them and support them. And in doing that, are there things that you can give to us that's helpful to help your child? So whether it is filling out a form of their likes and dislikes, their strengths, their challenges, just any and all information. Not that information is going to then go, oh, actually, no, we can't have your kid here. It's actually, what can we do to help support your kid? So, if there's something that we actually just genuinely don't know and something's gone wrong, or we're having communication problems with your child in our ministry, that's not going to be totally helpful. But if the parent can communicate that because they know it, that'll be great. So creating a space of love, care, support. I think also networking parents with other parents as well, particularly that are on a similar journey. I've heard of one place where one mum was, she left her job to commit herself to full-time care for her son, learning things, equipping herself as much as she could to help her child. But on the other side, there was a mum who just really had no idea what to do, was so overwhelmed, and what do I do? And how can we partner those kind of parents up and create a support network and a support group? Just to encourage, to help, to love, and just go, you know what, even when there are going to be times that are tricky and hard that we'll need to work together with, you are always welcome. You belong here. We want you here.
Yeah, I really want to say the best thing you can do is ask. The expert in their experience will always be the person themselves, and often their parents, particularly when you're working with children and young people. So keep asking and partnering with parents. Keep asking that question of what can we be doing to support you. And also, really importantly, I think it's so helpful to say, we love having your kid here, or we love having you here. That can make such a difference in a world where kids are so often treated as a problem to be solved. So just keep telling parents how much you love their kids, how much you love having them in their program. Keep telling kids how much you love having them here, that their presence is valuable and important and precious. That's such an important way to partner with parents, but also just to communicate the gospel value that we all gain by having their kids as part of our churches.
Wonderful. Well, thank you, Beck. Thank you, Luke. It's been really, really helpful. You guys have set up a Facebook group for those who are particularly interested in thinking about church ministry to youth and children with additional needs. Where can we find that?
If you search Accessible Kids and Youth Ministry in Facebook, you might be able to find it. Some people we've talked to this conference, it's been hard to find. So contact Beck with what you've got in show notes, and that will be the best way to get to be a part of that, I think.
Fantastic. If I can get the link working, I'll put that into the show notes as well. But if not, you can email beckbaines@youthworks.net and she will be able to hook you up with those. We'd love to see people from churches all over Sydney, all over the world, connecting there and sharing their ideas. So if you are in ministry, you've got those with additional needs in your group, whether it by neurodiversity or any other sort of additional need, you're welcome in that group to be sharing ideas and resources and learning from each other.
The Effective Ministry Podcast is a production of YouthWorks in Sydney. We want to see effective youth and children's ministry in every church. And one of the ways that you can help us do that is by letting people know about this podcast in all the usual ways, like comment, share, and review on your favorite social media and podcasting platform. If you've got comments, thoughts, or questions for this podcast, you can email us at effectiveministrypodcast@youthworks.net. And also check out youthworks.net for other ways that YouthWorks can help you have an effective youth and children's ministry in your church.